Well, good morning and thank you to ISDA for the opportunity to speak here today. When I last addressed this forum 3 years ago, it was a time of quite significant stress in global financial markets. A particular focus of concern at that time was the unfolding crisis in Greece and the associated risk of spillovers to other parts of Europe. A lot's happened since then. As a general observation, financial conditions around the world have been gradually recovering, though not without some periodic bouts of nervousness. The concerns about Greece came to a head around the middle of this year, and spillovers from that have so far turned out to be quite limited. More generally, the world economy has been expanding at a reasonable pace over these 3 years, and the process of balance sheet repair has continued. All of these are positive developments. Nonetheless, in some important respects, the situation is still some way from a return to normal. The after effects of the global crisis are still weighing on activity in some of the major economies. And interest rate settings around the world are still at exceptionally low levels to support growth 7 years after the crisis reached its height. All of that underscores the point that financial crises are costly events. They're costly in terms of lost income and output, and lost jobs and damage to institutions. And we've seen again that it takes a lot longer to recover from a financial crisis than it does from other types of economic downturn. All these are good reasons for the global efforts that have been made over the last few years to build resilience in our financial systems. A great deal of work is underway on that front at both the national and international levels. In Australia, we've had a major inquiry into the financial system, which, as one of its priorities, made a number of recommendations to strengthen financial resilience. Key recommendations in that area have been endorsed by the government just this week. Internationally, there's been an extensive program of reform initiated by the G20 and coordinated through the international standard-setting bodies. Today, I want to focus on just one aspect of that work, namely the move to central clearing of over-the-counter derivatives. As you know, this was initiated by the G20 commitments made at the Pittsburgh Summit in 2009. While progress on those commitments has been slower than many would have liked, a lot has been achieved. In my talk this morning, I'd like to review what's been done so far, highlight some of the key considerations in implementing these changes in Australia, and look ahead at what remains to be done. So first of all, what's been achieved so far? When I spoke at this conference in October 2012, the Australian Council of Financial Regulators had provided its advice to the government, following on from the G20 commitments, and the legislative response to that advice was well underway. The resulting amendments to the Corporations Act came into force at the beginning of 2013. These gave the responsible minister the power, under the advice of the regulators, to develop and determine particular products for mandatory trade reporting, for central clearing, or for platform trading. They also gave ASIC the power to elaborate on the details of those obligations by setting derivative transaction rules. As I foreshadowed then, the immediate priority once the legislation came into effect was to introduce a broad-based trade reporting requirement. That regime is now substantially in force. Given its mandate for financial stability, the Reserve Bank's primary interest has been in the central clearing component of the package, and it's worked closely on this with the other council agencies. Initially, the agencies favoured an incentives-led transition to central clearing, but for reasons that I'll come back to, the council ultimately turned its attention to a mandated approach. An important initial step was to establish a framework for assessing the case for any mandatory clearing obligations. That framework was then applied in the regulator's published reports on the Australian OTC derivatives markets in July 2013 and in April 2014. Together, those reports made recommendations for the government to proceed with clearing obligations for interest rate derivatives denominated in Australian dollars and in the four major global currencies. As most of you here would know, the government just a few weeks ago issued a determination consistent with those recommendations. The government also released amendments to the corporations regulations restricting the institutional scope of the regime to internationally active dealers. ASIC is now in the process of finalising its derivative transaction rules. These will set out in further details of the mandatory clearing requirements, including how the mandate will apply to cross-border transactions, the use of overseas CCPs to meet the mandate, and the effective commencement date in 2016. Now, in designing and implementing these mandatory obligations, there have been a number of important considerations to be taken into account. The aim throughout all of this has been to ensure that the financial stability benefits of central clearing are achieved while also supporting effective market functioning and keeping the Australian market globally connected. What I'd like to do now is to talk in a bit more detail about how the regulators have sought to achieve that balance. Central clearing potentially offers a range of benefits. They include centralised and standardised risk management, reduced counterparty risk due to multilateral netting, a less complex and more transparent hub and spokes structure for exposures, coordinated default management, and operational improvements and efficiencies. CCPs also provide a focal point for regulation and oversight. These benefits are likely to be greatest for products that are traded widely and which give rise to large counterparty exposures when they are not centrally cleared. In our domestic context, the regulators have identified Australian dollar interest rate swaps and swaps denominated in the major currencies as having these characteristics, and so these are the products that were prioritised. The trade-off, of course, is that CCP clearing concentrates risk in just one or just a few systemically important entities, which might be critical for the functioning of the wider system. This has always been recognised in the debate. But as the share of activity that's centrally cleared has gone up, this systemic dependence has attracted increasing attention. It's critical that these facilities are highly resilient to shocks, that they maintain continuity of service, and that they maintain the confidence of market participants. Recognising all this, the relevant international standard-setting bodies in 2012 published an enhanced set of stability standards for these critical facilities. These are the Principles for Financial Market Infrastructures, or PFMI. They establish requirements in all areas of CCP design and operation, including legal and governance arrangements, credit and liquidity risk management, settlement, default management, business and operational risk. And they also set standards in relation to access, efficiency, and transparency. These requirements have been widely adopted internationally, and they've been included domestically in the Reserve Bank's financial stability standards. The bank has found them to be a sound basis for supervisory dialogue on risk matters with the entities that we supervise. An application of the principles has already been an important catalyst for a range of enhancements in the risk management practices of the CCPs under the Reserve Bank's supervision. ASIC has addressed other aspects of the principles in its supervision and policy setting activities, including by setting out their expectations of how licensed CCPs should comply with their license obligations. Given the particular importance of continuity of service, a key focus of the debate in all of this has been on what might be called Plan B, that is, how to ensure that if a severe stress event ever did occur and threaten the viability of a CCP, it could continue to operate uninterrupted. There are two strands to the work in this area: recovery, which refers to actions taken by the CCP itself in a stress event, and resolution, which refers to actions taken by the resolution authority within the framework of a special regime to restore viability. The principles require that the tools and powers available to a CCP in recovery allow for any residual losses and liquidity shortfalls to be allocated comprehensively. So in theory, if a CCP in stress was able to implement its recovery plan in full, resolution should never be necessary. But a special resolution regime is nevertheless an important backstop. Resolution actions might be called into play if a CCP faced challenges for whatever reason in executing its recovery plan without public intervention, or if there were broader financial stability grounds for the resolution authority to intervene. A number of jurisdictions are now developing special resolution regimes for these facilities in accordance with an agreed international framework developed by the Financial Stability Board. In Australia, the government consulted on a proposed regime in the first half of this year. Under the proposal, the Reserve Bank would be the resolution authority for domestically incorporated CCPs and security settlement facilities. Its mandate would be to pursue the overarching objective of financial stability, with an additional key objective of ensuring continuity in the provision of critical services. Now, in implementing all of these reforms, the Australian authorities have been careful to do so in a way that supports market functioning and avoids imposing unnecessary costs. This was reflected in the initial preference for industry-led solutions that relied on private incentives. The decision ultimately to recommend a mandated approach and the government's acceptance of that advice were driven importantly by considerations of international consistencies. In a number of cases, products had already been mandated for clearing in other jurisdictions, notably interest rate derivatives denominated in the major currencies. The regulators took into account the benefits that could arise in such cases from favourable comparability assessments of the Australian regime and from avoiding opportunities for regulatory arbitrage. These, of course, needed to be balanced against any possible adverse implications from regulatory intervention that might have for market functioning. When they issued their recommendation in respect of the major currency interest rate derivatives, the regulators were confident that the industry had already made considerable progress in the transition to central clearing for these products in Australia. The incremental cost of regulatory intervention was therefore expected to be low. Then by April 2014, when the regulators recommended that Australian dollar interest rate derivatives be included in the clearing mandate, the Australian banks were already well advanced in becoming direct participants of the licensed clearing entities, LCH ClearNet and ASX Clear Futures. During the period since those recommendations were made, the transition to central clearing among Australian banks has continued to accelerate, even though the clearing mandate has only recently been confirmed and has yet to take effect. All four major banks are now active participants of the licensed clearers, and across products, more than 40% of Australian banks' outstanding OTC interest rate swaps have been centrally cleared via LCHC. Both pricing and regulatory factors have contributed to this. Obviously, the anticipation of a mandate being introduced has been an important factor. But more generally, over time, a material pricing differential has opened up between cleared and non-cleared transactions and has reinforced this trend. Our liaison with Australian banks indicates that they are now clearing centrally almost all new trades that are eligible for clearing, and that they've also made considerable progress in backloading legacy trades into CCPs. In the case of Australian dollar interest rate derivatives, this has contributed to an increase in total notional cleared to more than $5 trillion. Since the regulators issued their recommendation, CME clearing has also become licensed in Australia, although it currently has no direct Australian participants. It's not yet clear how the competitive dynamics in this area will evolve from here. Another important consideration for the regulators was the institutional scope of the clearing mandate. The government ultimately followed the regulators' advice that the clearing mandates should only apply to internationally active dealers. Overall, the regulators weren't convinced of the public policy case to extend clearing mandates to non-dealers. They took the view that systemic risk reduction from that might be limited, given the relatively small scale of non-dealers' activity and their typical hedging motivation. There were questions also about access to appropriate clearing arrangements for non-dealers, and the international consistency motivation was also weaker in that case. Reinforcing this conclusion, recent evidence suggests that non-dealers' access to clearing agency services may be becoming more limited, with a number of instances of clearing agents stepping back from this business. Another area that I'd like to touch on today is the cross-border dimension. Given the global nature of the OTC derivatives market, this has been a prominent part of the international policy debate. A particular focus has been on the cross-border application of some jurisdictions' rules and arrangements for deference and cooperation among regulators. For a jurisdiction like Australia, with a relatively small but highly globally interconnected financial sector, these things are very important. A key consideration has been to ensure that regulatory settings allow Australian institutions to remain globally connected. Another is to ensure that the desired outcomes are achieved without duplicating the regulatory costs faced by market participants. ASIC has given considerable thought to these questions as part of its rulemaking on mandatory clearing, and the Australian agencies have worked with overseas regulators closely on the cross-border dimension. Let me just give you one concrete example of that. In recent years, equivalence assessments of the Australian regimes have been undertaken by the relevant European authority, ESMA. These assessments were used to determine whether the European authorities would allow Australian rules to apply or would impose their own requirements on Australian institutions. In the case of CCPs, the Australian regime was given an unconditional positive assessment of equivalence by ESMA in late 2013. This ultimately led to recognition for the two CCPs in the ASX group under the European Market Infrastructure Regulation. Similarly, in the United States, ASX Clear Futures recently became the first foreign CCP to obtain an exemption from registration as a derivatives clearing organisation by the CFTC. This was effectively recognition of the equivalence of the Australian regulatory regime, and it avoided a potentially costly duplication of requirements for that business. Of course, the mutual recognition process needs to work in both directions, and the Australian regulators have conducted similar equivalence assessments for foreign CCPs seeking to offer their services here. In recent years, both LCH and CME have been licensed to offer services in Australia. In both cases, this occurred under a provision requiring the overseas regulatory regime to be deemed sufficiently equivalent to that in Australia and to be supported by supervisory cooperation arrangements between the domestic and overseas regulators. The resulting oversight regime maintains a broad equivalence of standards. It avoids regulatory overlap, and it provides for deference to the home regulator. One other important aspect to be considered was the framework for domestic location requirements for systemically important facilities. Early on in the policy process in Australia, a key question was the extent to which we should allow for our domestic market to be cleared by an overseas-based CCP. After careful consideration, it was decided not to insist on domestic incorporation. Although a financial stability argument might have been made for that, the regulators took the view that it could risk market fragmentation and that it might not be sustainable in a rapidly changing global market. Instead, the Council has developed a graduated framework for imposing additional regulatory requirements depending on the importance of the CCP to the domestic economy. In 2013, LCH became the first CCP to be granted an overseas licence and to fall within the scope of that framework. LCH has since established operational and governance arrangements commensurate with the scale of its services to Australian participants. It has also established Australian dollar liquidity arrangements consistent with the requirements for a systemically important CCP, including opening an exchange settlement account with the Reserve Bank. And as part of the oversight arrangements, the bank is also represented on a global college for LCH, as well as a newly established crisis management group for that entity. Since CME's operations in Australia are currently limited, additional requirements under the regulatory influence framework haven't been triggered in that case. But the bank and ASIC nevertheless have a joint memorandum of understanding with the CFTC to support deference arrangements, both in respect of CME and in respect of the CFTC's interest in the ASX service. A few words about what remains to be done. When I spoke here last time, I made the comment that there would be more work ahead, both for the regulators and for the market, and I fear that that is still the case. Some elements of the global derivatives reform package have yet to be completed. For instance, the international margining regime for non-centrally cleared derivatives is not due to come into force until next September. And APRA is leading domestic work on local implementation of that regime. At the same time, ASIC has been working on a framework for assessing the case for mandatory platform trading. And this is one of the topics that will be considered in the regulator's next assessment report to be published next month. Internationally, work is continuing on CCP resilience, on recovery and resolution, and on cross-border cooperation. And the Australian regulators will continue to engage with all of that. Let me draw all this together with a few concluding remarks. As I said at the outset, the work on derivatives reform is just one part of a wider effort to build resilience in our financial systems. Given the global nature of these markets, the regulatory work has necessarily had a strong international dimension. In engaging with this, the Australian regulators have sought to keep several objectives in mind. Of course, there's the overarching objective of financial stability. But there are a number of other important aims to be taken into account. The need to maintain connectedness for our institutions with the rest of the world, avoiding costly duplication or inconsistency of requirements with other jurisdictions, and ensuring that regulatory settings are proportionate to the risks that need to be managed. In balancing all of those aims, we recognise that it's important to consult thoroughly with market participants at each stage of the process. We take that very seriously, and so I take the opportunity today to thank market participants and to thank ISDA for the constructive way that you've engaged with us on all of these reforms. Thanks for your attention today.
Thank you very much for those remarks. We have a couple of questions, if you don't mind. At the top of the speech, you mentioned data. As an economist, you've spent your time looking at data. Are you satisfied with the data quality and the information being reported, and are regulators effectively being able to effectively use the data?
I think a lot has been done to upgrade data availability. It's been a consistent theme when we've had crises around the world that one of the first responses to that is a call for better data so that we'll have better early warning indicators and better opportunity to take appropriate action to manage risk. So a lot's been done on that front in the wake of the global crisis. One of the initiatives that was mentioned this morning has been the trade reporting requirements, but increased transparency is being required on a whole range of fronts. My general sense is there's always more you can do in this area, but regulators and analysts do have a lot of data available now, and I think the challenge is to make best use of that, to keep on working to improve our analysis, to make sure that we manage risk as effectively as we can.
If I could just expand on that, how important is it for global regulators to share the data? I mean, the data available to you in Australia is a certain amount of data relative to what the U.S. and European yet you have all these systemically interconnected facilities and market participants. How important is it for you to, as regulators, share that data and move forward with that?
We view that as important. So, for example, with the trade repository data, we've entered into cooperative arrangements with other regulators to ensure appropriate sharing of data on that front. Similarly, with supervision of CCPs, once you have cooperative arrangements for mutual recognition, you also need to have information sharing. And in our case, we've entered into arrangements with the CFTC and with the Bank of England to share information in those areas. I think those things are very important.
Good, thank you. Now, you mentioned that Plan B was recovery and resolution. A third R has been added recently to the discussion, and that's resilience. And that largely has to do with the ability of, you know, largely around transparency and reviewing of stress testing, risk management practices of a CCP. How important do you view that third R, that resilience, in terms of kind of regulatory tools available?
Well, it's very important that resilience is the first line of defense. Because you don't want to get into a situation of extreme stress where you have to activate recovery plans. That's your second line of defence, and then the third line of defence is resolution if the first two lines fail. But we put a lot of effort into resilience, and I know that other supervisors of these facilities are doing the same. The work on resilience actually has been our main work as a supervisor at the Reserve Bank, because we haven't had resolution powers up to this point. And so in our case, for us, it's important to supplement that with additional powers on that front. But I definitely think that resilience is your first line of defence.
Good. Well, please thank Assistant Governor Malcolm Eady for his comments today and joining us today. We're going to move to the next panel, which will be resolution, recovery, and resilience. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.